Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about two friends, Watson and Holmes. This is episode number 129. We're going to talk about specifically the book called The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yes, that was the first collection of short stories.
Right. So not the first story written, but the first collection of short stories.
The first things written about Sherlock Holmes were two novels, A Study in Scarlet and The Sign of the Four. And then The Strand magazine was started by somebody that Holmes, Conan Doyle knew. And they were trying to think of a way to keep people coming back, but so that it didn't matter if they missed one of the serials that were being printed. And Doyle went, hey, I've got a cool idea. What you have is not the ongoing storyline, but you have the ongoing character they care about. You have somebody like this character. And so he agreed to do these stories.
Okay.
I thought that was kind of neat, is they're just thinking of how do we get them to come back to the magazine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. So, yeah, this book was published in 1892, and the stories appeared, it looks like, 1891 through 1892.
Mm.
And I'm always interested in contemporaries, and I was just looking up what else happened in 1892. And interestingly enough, J.R.R. Tolkien was born in 1892.
A good sign.
Yeah. And see, some of the books that came out, some of the writers that were contemporaries, Robert Louis Stevenson, who we've talked about,
yes.
Mark Twain, Jules Verne, Thomas Hardy, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, The Yellow Wallpaper. I think we've heard that one. But yeah, so that's kind of, so this is after Dickens, post-Dickens. Dickens is the wheel rolls around Dickens, right?
At this podcast, in my life.
Yeah.
Well, so then was Wilkie Collins also before him, I guess, because he wrote mystery stories or novels, The Woman in White and The Moonstone. And they kind of had some of that sensational flair that at least, well, Doyle did those in his short stories too, but he did them in his novels where he'd start off in contemporary England and then you'd find the thread of the mystery solution would go back to America, which was, of course, exotic, or India, somewhere like that. And the Moonstone did that too.
Okay, yeah, so it says Wilkie Collins, his last work was 1888.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, we're pretty close to the same time frame.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah, he wrote something called The Haunted Hotel.
I know. I keep wanting to read that.
It looks like it's cool. Yeah.
I know.
All right.
He had a lot of things I've never read, so he may be after Dickens. He'll be my next exploration. I'm almost done with Dickens.
Nice. Almost done with Dickens.
I've
that
just started
amazing.
the last one, which was his last book.
Yeah.
The Mystery of Edwin Drood.
Oh, how about that?
Which is only half done, so it's a true mystery.
Hmm.
No one knows how it ended.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, he died halfway through, unfortunately.
Shoot.
Yeah.
Have many people finished it?
Yeah.
Okay, I figured.
A bunch of people have tried, and there was evidently somebody who was close to being contemporary who went ahead and, I guess, kind of got the go-ahead or something to kind of write what he thought would have been the end of the book. And from what I've seen, a lot of people say this does seem to be what logically from his few notes would have happened. But so I'll look for that when I'm done.
Interesting. I know Dan Simmons wrote a book called Drood.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what's up with that one or what that's about.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, because I think there's a play that goes around every so often where they'll act it out and then get the audience to say what they think or, participate because nobody knows.
Wow, I had no idea. That's cool.
Oh, yes. I'm still cursed the speaking tour he went on, which further sapped his failing strength and killed him.
Curses.
But that's beyond this podcast.
That's right. Sorry. No. That's really interesting. All right. So we're going to talk about Arthur Conan Doyle, which Wikipedia says his full name is Sir Arthur Ignatius Conan Doyle.
Well, he did have a Jesuit school.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. I think so, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, he's an interesting guy. I'd hope to delve more into his life before the podcast. But, he was trained as a doctor at the University of Edinburgh. So he was born in 1859 and died in 1930. And, he started to write these Sherlock Holmes stories. Dr. Watson, famously, Dr. Watson is the narrator of all the stories. It's not first person from Sherlock Holmes. It's first person from Dr. Watson.
Yeah, just a few of the later ones have Holmes, who always starts off going, these are a lot harder than I thought.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's one or two, and he'll say things like, I now understand why Watson put in all this story stuff. It's hard to just tell the facts, you know.
Oh, how about that? That's cool. I like it.
Yeah.
So Dr. Watson, they think that he represents Conan Doyle himself. What do you call that? A Mary Sue? I can't remember what the term is now.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, just putting yourself in the story.
Well, did you ever see Without a Clue?
Without a Clue. That sounds familiar to me.
It's maybe from the 1980s. It's Ben Kingsley as Watson and Michael Caine as Holmes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's really – so you've seen it?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, it's delightful. Mm-hmm. And it's the whole reason there are the stories about Holmes is because nobody wanted to read about John Watson, crime doctor. So you kind of go, oh.
John Watson, crime doctor.
Yeah, exactly. I like it. I have to agree. It's not as compelling. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's right. So, I'm not familiar with the happenings in the first two novels. It's been so long since I've read them. But these stories take place kind of all over his life. You know, there was one story, Watson was married at some point, I assume, in the previous novels, right?
Well, yeah, the one right before this is the one where he meets Mary.
Okay.
And they have a romance throughout the novel.
Okay, so then he's married off stage, I guess.
Yes.
And then, these stories, the first thing he does in every story is place this in his life somewhere. And
right.
He says, I had been married, for this long, or this happened before I got married.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So every story was sort of, just somewhere in his life. And, Watson tells you the state of his life as he starts to get into the story.
Yeah, that's true. It's like my wife was off visiting her sister or something. And so I was staying in our bachelor digs again. And that's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought about the fact that he's always putting you in the timeline. Well, and it's like the other thing he does, which I love in a lot of these stories, where he says, well, we had just finished investigating this interesting sounding case, and it's kind of was almost not as crazy as that case with Sir So-and-so and the vampires, but then this is really crazier than either. I could tell it to you. And so he gives him this rich history along with that other timeline.
Yeah. And that's, it makes you want to go find the stories that he's talking about. And he's talking about real stories, right?
Not
all of them. Okay, because some of them I recognized.
Okay,
he would mention in one of the later stories, one of the previous stories in this collection. So I know that some of them were true.
Yeah, but most of them,
I say true.
Yeah,
some of them existed in story form.
I'm pretty Well, you know, I believe Holmes actually did. No, some people, though, there's a Holmes Society, you know, uh-huh. Sherlock Society, that they act as if he did exist. And I have a series of annotated Sherlock Holmes or three books that have everything in them. Uh-huh. And it's kind of annoying because half the notes are written about his timeline and his life as if it did exist, and people trying to work out the times. And I'm like, people, he was just writing the stories, okay? He wasn't keeping track of a real man's life.
Wow. Wow.
So
fascinating. Yeah.
Sorry, I hijacked you again.
No, you're fine. So, yeah. So the book itself, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, contains 12 stories. They are A Scandal in Bohemia, The Adventure of the Red-Headed League, A Case of Identity, The Boscombe Valley Mystery, The Five Orange Pips, The Man with the Twisted Lip, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, The Adventure of the Speckled Band, The Adventure of the Engineer's Thumb, The Adventure of the Noble Bachelor, The Adventure of the Barrel Coronet, and The Adventure of the Copper Beeches. So those are the stories that are contained in there. And if you're like me, having as a youngster, I read a lot of Holmes, nowhere near everything, but I had to dip into Holmes. I remember I have a really clear memory of reading The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Of course. That's yeah. His most famous.
Right.
And I would argue maybe his best.
Yeah? Okay.
Well, novel.
Uh-huh. Gotcha.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Cool. No, that's great. That's great. But I read these titles and they all meant something to me. Even though I wasn't totally clear, I couldn't have told you all the stories. Uh-huh. But I was like, yeah, that's familiar, like the Red-Headed League. And Case of Identity is one that stuck in there.
Really?
And, yeah. And trying to see, there was one other one that I was like, oh, I remember this. Might have been the Pips.
Yeah, for me, the Five Orange Pips. Because if you're an American and you're reading it, you get partway into the story and you're like, wait, KKK, does that mean what I think it means?
Yeah.
Well, guess exactly. What it does.
It does, right.
Mm-hmm. But think how exotic that would have been in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah.
To people who weren't living in the United States, or even, I mean, you know, a lot of people even who weren't in the South.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, anyway. And I like it. I like how Holmes sometimes says, get me the K volume of the American Encyclopedia. You know, so he drops that and says, aha, Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
Yep.
Or there's one time where he's there, it's like a really terrible weather outside and it's the evening and he's like, I was reading this. Holmes was moodily sorting his many reference works into, you know, his clippings into, you know, order or something.
Yeah.
So you imagine him seeing something in the paper and just, well, I'm going to cut that one out because I might need to know that later.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. He'd be a good, he'd have his own database.
Oh,
yeah.
Which is why the, you know, the current ones have so much computer stuff in them.
Yeah, I like that. I definitely want to mention that Sherlock series. But one of the things I love about that is how Watson has a blog.
Yeah.
And he's blogging all these stories.
Right. It's the contemporary way he would have done it.
And
right?
I love it. And I like how Sherlock sometimes rolls his eyes at the titles of the posts.
Yeah.
You know, that's good stuff.
Yeah, ridiculous.
I like it.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot. So I thought what we ought to do, and we did before the podcast, is we each picked a couple of the stories that we particularly liked. I did like all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But we picked a couple that we really liked. I think rather than try and talk about 12 stories, let's talk about four.
Well, I was thinking really quickly before we launched into that, I just wanted to make one last point, which was the two novels didn't take off the way the stories did. And I think it was the combination of this new Strand magazine with the idea of the serials and then writing these short stories, which encapsulate everything so succinctly, you know, of the Holmes mystique and the mysteries and the logic and the exotic stuff. And So it was when the stories began that his popularity suddenly really grew.
Okay.
And by the end of the stories, he was tired of writing them because he said he had to put as much effort into each short story for the plot as he had to into a novel.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
And so he wanted to kill Sherlock Holmes. But and he his did, wife, right? Well, it, and in the second set of stories at the end, he does. And then talk about Holmes being real. People in London and other places were wearing, you know, those black bands of mourning around their sleeves.
Oh, wow.
He's being hounded by
so
everyone.
So he was the George R.R. Martin of his day.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. It was just top happening pop culture. It was like, pick the hottest TV show, movie, book, whatever you want, podcast. It was the serial of its day, you know, kind of thing. And so he wrote, I think after that was when he wrote The Hound of the Baskervilles, but he very carefully said, this happened before he died. So he wasn't going to get roped back into the short stories. And eventually he gave into the pressure and wrote a bunch more of them because so if these were in 1892 or whenever began, 1891, I mean, I think he wrote them until like the 1920s or 30s.
Wow.
And so in the beginning of the last collection, he says, what other fictional character has spanned this time period? And then but the thing was that I loved is that his wife talked him out of killing Holmes at the end of this. And so she suggested the plot for The Copper Beeches, which is the last story in the novel. So
fascinating.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So I kind of liked that.
Yeah, I like that kind of stuff. Did he bring Holmes back from the dead or say anything like, well, that, you know, in later stories?
Oh, well, yeah. The third.
I realized that you said that he did Hound of the Baskervilles, which happened before. But did anything happen after the final problem in the timeline? Or did he just keep saying, keep writing stories that happened before that story?
Well, so it's the, was it that something falls, right?
Rick and something falls.
Is that not the name of that story?
I thought The Final Problem.
The Final Problem. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I thought The Final Problem was the name of the story.
Yeah, then there's one, gosh, I wish I could remember the name of it, but Watson's going along and there's a whole mystery story where he suddenly discovers that Holmes is alive.
Okay.
And Holmes then tells how he lived through it because that's when there was so much pressure. He went, okay, fine.
Okay.
I'll do it.
That's fascinating.
You know, kind of like, I'm sick of being bothered and everybody drove a dump truck of money up to my house. So, okay. And so then that launched. I think there are three more books of stories or two more at least. Okay. I mean, there are a lot more stories.
Cool.
And they also name other stories, you know, like, you know, well, after I'd helped the Pope in the Vatican and I came back, did this, you know, and so people have then filled in with their own versions of those stories a lot of the time.
That is funny. So some of the stuff that he mentions that way were probably current happenings, huh?
I mean, things were
in the news, you know, so if he says something like, I helped the Pope in the Vatican or whatever, is it just like common knowledge, people are saying, probably had something to do with the whatever happened.
Oh, well, no, because he'd usually give it a name. You know how on some of these I can't find one. I thought I had marked them, but he'll say, after the strange case of the Belgian king and you know, the cigarette or whatever, you know, that's not exotic enough, but so he'll just give it some exotic thing and move on. But anyway, so I found that so interesting. And something else I read was saying that everybody will say, you know, Edgar Allan Poe was the beginner of the mystery story. And he had Dupin, I think was the name of his character. And they said, so why didn't people get as involved with those as they did with Sherlock Holmes? And they said, well, because Dupin wasn't really a fully rounded character and his companion, the unnamed narrator, is featureless. And it says, while the puzzles Dupin unravels are intriguing, they do not engage the emotions or generate strong enthusiasm. Certainly not in the way the Holmes tales were destined to do. You know, there's no societies or films or all that like we have now. And so these mysteries and this is the point I was going to make, which I took a long way to. But so these mysteries, because they were essentially the introduction, were the ones where Arthur Conan Doyle got the chance to define his character more closely for everyone. You got, mm-hmm. I mean, I think the first one, which is A Scandal in Bohemia,
mm-hmm.
is the about Irene Adler, is the first, or maybe it's the second one, wherever one the one is where he's bored and he's taking cocaine, that might be the second one, actually. The Redheaded League. Anyway, that's the first time that's really mentioned, is what I've read, and I didn't go check up on that, so if I'm wrong, I apologize. But this is when he got to put in all those little characteristics.
Gotcha.
That he later yeah. built on.
Yeah, I remember in the later story, they mentioned cocaine.
Yeah, and that might says be the first that. Story.
Yeah, but as far as him actually taking it, it was mentioned in another one that they were describing Holmes or something like that. I can't remember what, but it mm-hmm. said cocaine and something else. Can't remember what it was, but yeah. But yeah, that's an interesting characteristic.
Well, yeah, and I like the fact that even though those were in the days when nobody was really condemning it specifically,
mm-hmm.
Watson continually kept going, it's bad for your health, man. You got to cut it out.
Right.
Yeah. So and yeah. he's like, I know, but I'm just terribly bored. My brain's so active. I have to do something.
Yeah. So. I wonder if cocaine had a use in medicine at that time.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
I thought it did too.
Yeah.
So it was around and in use.
Yeah. Well, and also the one other thing, I'm sorry, I know a lot more about
no, him please,
in
yeah.
general terms than no, I thought I did. He modeled Holmes on, I believe the doctor's name was Dr. Bell, who was an instructor at uh-huh. Edinburgh College and also an actual doctor. And he was very specific, very good at tracking things back, very good at looking at cause and effect. And he could do some of these things that he has Holmes doing. So he took him and expanded upon him to create Sherlock Holmes. So that was his model.
Interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he would write his medical practice did not do very well. And so in his spare time, while he was waiting around for patients, he would write stories. And I don't think they were all Sherlock Holmes. I think, you know, because he wrote all kinds of stuff. He wrote weird fiction, and he wrote one of the first Lost World stories as a novel, the Professor Challenger books.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
a lot of those things, I think, had their genesis then when he was just trying to do anything to scrabble some money and occupy himself, too.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how many of the Challenger stories there are, but that was another character of his.
Yeah, right? There's three or four novels, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway.
So, nope. I love it.
As you were. Sorry.
Yeah, as I were.
Yes. All as right. you were, sir.
All right. So my first favorite is The Adventure of the Red-Headed League, which I really liked. I love a good heist.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I love heist stories, and this was one of them. The earliest one that I've read. I love, you know, the opening is so typical. You know, I had called upon my friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, one day in the autumn of last year and found him in deep conversation with a very stout, florid-faced, elderly gentleman with fiery red hair. With an apology for my intrusion, I was about to withdraw when Holmes pulled me abruptly into the room and closed the door behind me. You could not possibly have come at a better time, my dear Watson, he said cordially. You know, I love that stuff. You know,
yeah.
It's like I was just walking around and Holmes pulled me in on this case. You know, and it was awesome.
Well, yeah, and you always think, too, it's funny because the way the stories are told, you never get the feeling, really, that he needs Watson to help him with solving the mystery. But he always says, oh, I would just love to have you along.
Yeah, that's true.
I'll bounce things off.
That's true. Yeah. They were friends, right?
Yeah,
They were good friends. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Holmes enjoyed his company.
Yeah.
That's for sure. We're not going to worry about spoilers, right?
Yeah.
Because these were written
pretty old stories.
1898 or 1891, that is.
We've already said he kills him off and brings him back, so I think we've spoiled everything.
Right. So this fellow comes up to Holmes, and the redheaded fellow, not Watson. And he says, you know, this really strange thing happened. These people gave me this job, or, you know, I answered an ad that said, you know, somebody, we need somebody with red hair to, you know, and so he shows up at this place, and it's this redheaded league, and they hire him immediately as soon as they see him. And his job is to copy the Encyclopedia Britannica by hand on pages and bring your own paper.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting.
I don't have paper or
detail.
Anything.
Yeah, so he brings paper and his pen and any ink and everything, and is just copying the Encyclopedia Britannica, and they're paying him very handsomely. And then suddenly they disappeared. There was a sign that said the Redheaded League is closed. And then he goes straight to Holmes to say, what the heck happened? What was this all about?
Please go ahead. I was going to say, what's funny about this is that is always what I remember too about the story. And so when I was rereading it, I thought, I had completely forgotten the whole reason he even knows about this. Is he's got his own business, but it's not doing really well.
Mm-hmm.
And so an assistant of his says, well, that's weird. You know, I saw this advertisement. I wish I was redheaded, says the guy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And he gives him the ad in the paper.
And the helper was in on it.
Yeah. And the helper was in on it.
Yeah.
So there's an inside man. And I hadn't thought about it as a heist job. I had thought about it as a diversion. What an interesting way to divert someone for your own purposes. But you're right. It's totally a heist. And and the guy is like, oh, I could use some extra cash. Not doing that great. Okay.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. So, yeah, what the heist was this guy's normal office was right next to a bank. So they used it to tunnel over to the bank, you know, which we've seen many times in movies and such.
Mm-hmm.
But they needed him out of the house. So they gave him this job to copy this encyclopedia. And it was brilliant. But Sherlock Holmes figured it out.
Well, yeah, and it's just like, wow, you really do need the money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was working my way through the A's.
Yeah, he was excited too.
Looking forward to the B's. Yeah,
and brings himself 16 pieces of paper, I think he said at one point.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay. And he had to be there. Yeah, the instructions were, you have to be here 4 hours a day. You have to be there. Get no leaving, neither sickness nor business or anything else.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't stay, you lose your billet. And he's like, okay. Yeah, and then the Redheaded League is dissolved. Once they had what they needed, then they closed it. Cruelly closed the Redheaded League.
I needed that money.
I needed that money. But yeah, I loved it. It was you know, the way Holmes figures it all out, you know, is always interesting. Now, do you feel in these stories, these aren't puzzles to be solved, really? Or maybe that's not quite the way to put it. It's like the mystery is always very interesting, but I never have hope of figuring it out. It's not like I stop and say, okay, what have I been given and can I figure it out? Do you do that?
Well, sometimes, I mean, at some point, but a lot of the times I'm just reading along, but there's always some part of my mind when I'm reading a mystery where I'm thinking, I think I could do it. Like I was just listening to one very different sort of a mystery and I kept thinking, oh, it's this, it's that, it's this. Now I never have any hopes of actually being right. So if I am ever right, I'm always just very pleased with myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
sometimes I would catch a detail and say, aha, you know, that's something.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's as deep as that got for me. You know, it's like, it's not like, you know, when Holmes starts to reveal everything, I don't stop and try to figure it out. But I know that some people do. And I wonder if the Holmes stories, do they contain everything that you need to figure it out? Like an Agatha Christie, she really, everything's there. Yeah. always.
Everything is there. Don't you think they are in these two?
It's very possible. I mean, yeah, it's very possible.
He always explains everything.
He does explain everything, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, it's like, I don't know, you know, when he describes some things, you know, about a person, I don't know that he includes all of that. You know, Holmes just says, well, because of your collar, I figured this, and because of this, I figured that. Sometimes all those details aren't in there until the reveal.
But I guess I'm thinking of things like what's the detail that's coming to mind is from the engineer's thumb or whatever it was called, which I also really liked a lot. And he says he was picked up at the station by, you know, somebody and got into the buggy or whatever. And he says, well, excuse me, was the horse tired or was it glossy?
Yes.
It's glossy and fresh. Okay, thanks. Right. Go on.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah. And so
and you're
then
like, okay,
on,
well, what does
he
that
says,
mean?
Yeah,
what
I knew.
Mean?
They took you out and back to fool you because that horse was too fresh. It was from very close by. And you're like, oh. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, if you were around back then, you would have known what that meant. And you might have known now.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like for the actual mystery itself, there are enough. And if you're reading a ton of them in a row, which, of course, you were never designed to do, you start to see patterns and things where you're like, is it the evil stepfather again? Is it the...
Yeah.
I still remember one of the later ones, and maybe it just wasn't as good a one. And I was like, it's the brother. It's the brother, and they think it's this way. And I was kind of wrong about the method, but I absolutely had it. But I'd read so many of them, so I can't give myself credit. But
cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, the Red-Headed League, it ends typically, but I love the endings, you know. You reasoned it out beautifully, I exclaimed in unfeigned admiration. It is so long a chain, and yet every link rings true. It saved me from, how do I pronounce, E-N-N-U-I, N-U-E?
Ennui.
Ennui, right. It saved me from ennui, he said. He answered, yawning. Alas, I already feel it closing upon me. My life is spent in one long effort to escape from the commonplaces of existence. These little problems help me to do so. And you are a benefactor of the race, said I. He shrugged his shoulders. Well, perhaps, after all, it is of some little use, he remarked. And then he says something in French that I cannot say.
Yeah.
And then, as Flaubert wrote to George Sand.
It's... So but, you're super smart, too.
Yeah.
I mean, super well educated. And
exactly.
But I love this story, too, because it's got in it the supervillain, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
The bank robber, he's like, I've been on his trail for a really long time, says Sherlock Holmes. I recognize something. And so when they're waiting and they're going to catch him, he's like, oh, you can't get away. We've got you this time. And he's like, okay. And the policeman is going to put the handcuffs on him. You know, just hold out while I fix the derbies. I beg that you will not touch me with your filthy hands, remarked our prisoner as the handcuffs clattered upon his wrists. You may not be aware that I have royal blood in my veins. Have the goodness also when you address me, always to say sir and please. So, you know, you've got this guy with delusions of grandeur who's pulling off this huge heist, and he's been wanted by the police for so long, and... Yeah, it's just put a cape on him and here we are at Superman.
That's true. Good point. I like it.
Or somebody Superman would try to get, I mean.
Yeah. 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 Neat. Neat, neat. So what's one of your favorites?
Oh, I liked, you know, it's funny because I feel like the headline is kind of nondescript, A Case of Identity.
Mm. Yeah.
And it has, when you read these, I guess what you realize is, these are such wonders of misdirection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's pulling us along the lines that he wants us to go until Holmes steps in and says, well, these three details, and redirects you to the real meaning behind everything. And basically they're hanging out together. I don't remember the reason why.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? In fact, I don't think he even says. He's just like, we're talking one night. And some woman comes in and what I liked about her is she was a large woman. So you get the idea she wasn't necessarily that attractive, but Holmes could tell she did typewriting and earned her living, and she said, oh, well, you know, I've got a bit of a competence and inheritance, but I'm living with my mother and stepfather, and so I feel like I'll just let them have it to help pay for my keep. And I like to work anyway. But I've met somebody, and we fell in love, Mr. Hosmer Angel, I guess is how you'd say his name. And I just really fell hard for him, and we'd only see each other every so often. And then he just disappeared on the way to the altar. Or on, was it on the way back from the altar? That's the worst thing. I should remember this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean. It was on the wedding day anyway.
Yeah, it was on the wedding day, mm-hmm. and he totally disappears. And she's like, I can't find him. I've done an ad. I don't know. I'm worried he's dead and all these kind of things. And basically what Holmes finds out is that it's the stepfather who's been dressing up as this other guy. Because it always was, well, my stepfather didn't get to meet him because he was in France on a business trip. And the mother's encouraging the match and all this kind of thing. And, oh, right before he disappeared, Mr. Hosmer Angel said, promise you'll wait for me. If anything happens, you'll never marry anyone except me. And so what Holmes finds out is the stepfather has been pretending to be this guy because they want to keep the money that she's been contributing to the household. And otherwise, he might have to go to work, really. And I just looked at this and thought, okay, first of all, this is a wonderful bit of misdirection. Second of all, it's one of the cruelest things I've ever read.
Yeah, this it is nasty.
Woman and how mm-hmm. horrible her mother and stepfather are to be willing to do this to her emotionally in order to keep her money. And it to me starts a pattern of every so often the evil stepfather pops up. Mm. A couple more times, at least once more, in this book too.
Yeah, and, yeah. My second favorite has a stepfather in it.
Yeah, and I guess that was at least it's not the stepmother, which is often the case. But
yeah, isn't that interesting? It's
yeah, it was the uncaring mother just as well. And I just I don't know why. I just the cruelty of leaving her on her wedding day, distraught.
Mm-hmm.
And being willing to do that to her. And then I thought, I guess this is the kind of thing people might do to each other. Because the reason these mysteries work and you care at all, because mostly they are just puzzles, is you care about Holmes and Watson, but you also care a lot of the time about the victims. Mm-hmm. They seem real.
Yeah, agreed. So, yeah, they always have an interesting story and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But their heartache or sorrow mm-hmm. or anxiety rings true. Yep. I mean, not maybe a scandal in Bohemia, because that's just, I don't care about that prince. But you're very interested in the mystery, and you're very interested in Irene Adler at that point.
True.
He's always got a compelling way to write another character into the story.
Does Irene Adler come back?
No.
Okay.
No, she's just always the woman. All that stuff in the new Sherlock Holmes stuff with Benedict Cumberbatch is not true.
Okay. Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, it's very dramatic. And it makes right. a good story. So why not use it?
He definitely admired her.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So I was, that's why I was curious if she returned.
She could match him for brains and mm-hmm. bested him.
Yeah.
But, well, the thing too is this one is the one where a lot of the times you kind of expect somebody like Sherlock Holmes is going to turn over the villain to justice. And that happens in the Red-Headed League. But in this one, he threatens to beat the stepfather, but the stepfather just runs away. And he says, there's a cold-blooded scoundrel, said Holmes, laughing as he threw himself down into his chair once more. That fellow will rise from crime to crime until he does something very bad and ends on a gallows. And then they say, so what are you going to do? And he says, well, if I tell her, she won't believe me. You mm-hmm. know, she doesn't want to believe the person she loved was her stepfather fooling her. So there's not even a resolution really to the person's problem, but it's the mystery has been solved, and so we don't necessarily care.
True.
And sometimes that happens. He decides for himself if it's worth the police seeing it or if his solution is the best one.
Yeah, yeah. He does often say, if you tell me this, then I won't tell the police. I remember one time he did that. But yeah, saying, just get out of here. Mm-hmm. Or something like that, rather than I'm going to call the police.
Yeah, he's often... Well, sometimes he's upset. I mean, he's like, this is dastardly, and I'm going to solve it somehow, you know, like the Boscombe Valley mystery.
Mm-hmm.
He makes sure that the young lovers wind up together. But he also doesn't force justice in that case either for a variety of reasons. He decides on justice himself a lot of the time. And I don't know that we disagree with him.
No, I don't know either. Yeah.
Yes, I feel like he should have told Miss Windibank or whatever, Miss whoever it was. But
Miss Windibank.
Miss Sutherland. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
About
her stepfather.
Oh, okay. She didn't.
She should have.
That's right. Yeah. She should know.
He says, and Miss Sutherland, if I tell her, she will not believe me. That's right. Remember the old Persian saying, there is danger for him who taketh the tiger cub, and danger also for whoso snatches a delusion from a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, okay.
So he saves her feelings.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, she won't think that. She'll always think he couldn't solve it, I guess. And she'll still... So, therefore... You know, we're thinking about it a lot more than anybody reading it because they were just going, oh, crazy. That was the answer.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, my next one is The Adventure of the Speckled Band, which also has a pretty evil stepfather in it.
Yeah, well, crazy. He is definitely crazy, I'd say, and evil.
Yeah, he's got some animals.
Oh, yeah. He's terrible.
Oh, shoot. So, yeah, so she comes to Holmes. Basically, she believes at that point that her stepfather is trying to kill her, but she doesn't know why. But she had a sister that died in a bed in this room in a pretty horrifying manner. You know, she came to her sister, you know, screaming the speckled band and then died in her arms.
Does she think he's trying to kill her at that point?
I think so. Well, she comes in and that's the impression that I got.
She's making excuses for him.
Yeah, yeah. But
he says, you've been hardly used or whatever because she has bruises. And he says, he doesn't know his strength sometimes.
So you didn't feel that she suspected?
Well, maybe she did, but I didn't feel like she said it. She just...
No, I don't know that she said it either, but, you know, she did. I felt like she was saying it without saying it.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. That's the impression that I got anyway.
Yeah, I just felt like she was super worried because I've heard that whistling that my sister heard in the night. And she died right after that going, the speckled band, the speckled band.
Right.
So it's very supernatural seeming.
It does, yeah. Yeah,
so she hears gypsies.
Yeah, whistling and what's going on here. And
yeah.
And then Holmes and Watson do a stakeout.
I do love that.
I just love that, yeah. So their plan is to... have this lady let them into the room and then she'll vacate and go somewhere else and through the window so that nobody knows that they're there. And then I loved the description about Watson and Holmes just sitting there in the dark waiting for something to happen. And it's hours. And Sherlock said, you know, don't fall asleep. Your life depends on it. And they sit there for hours and hours. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly something does happen. And so what happens is the stepfather is putting a snake into the room through the vent. And Holmes manages to send the snake right back at him.
Yeah.
And ends up killing the stepfather, which was great.
Oh, yes. Justice was done.
Justice was done there. Yeah. So he... But it's fun, you know, I love the description of them sitting in the dark And then I love that, you know, Holmes is like, well, you know, I knew how to send a snake back. You know, sometimes he pulls out these obscure bits of knowledge, like, you know, of course, you know, this is what you do. And I was able to send that snake right back using my whatever. Makes me laugh, but I love it.
Well, I also like when he says, well, actually, I was on the wrong track to begin with.
Mm.
Gypsies. I just, you know, like she mentioned gypsies and I was off on the wrong trail.
Off on the gypsies.
We all know they're a problem usually. But once we got to the room, I could see. So, yeah. And also, you forget this one is great because it's got so many supernatural, exotic elements. First of all, there's that band of gypsies that keeps getting mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then the doctor himself is horrible, the stepfather doctor.
Yeah.
And so you do know that she's being abused and she can't get away from him and she is upset about that. And so you've got that evil influence. And then he's got all these exotic pets. So, oh, well, that was the baboon, says Holmes at one point. You know? It's like, oh.
Yeah, I remember that. He said, well, why do you lock your door? And she says, well, there's a cheetah and a baboon wandering around. He's like, all right, go on.
Around at night.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah. But, you know, also, you know, I did, you said that she was being abused and I felt the same way. And I was wondering if he was asking for that reason. Why do you lock your door? You know,
mm-hmm.
because, well, oh. There's this guy in the house that I don't like.
Well, that could be too.
Yeah. So.
The cheetah's a handy excuse.
Yeah. The cheetah's not going to open the door if it's, you know, not locked.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Unless there are loose doors that you just bump against. Yeah. I also like that Holmes is, it's a swamp adder, cried Holmes, the deadliest snake in India. Of course he knows that.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
I guess it was probably under S for either snake or swamp adder in his Indian encyclopedia.
That's too funny. So, yeah, and I love the supernatural element in this story. Now, mm-hmm. I know that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a spiritualist. He was into the seances and all that stuff. He had a pretty deep belief in the supernatural. Are there stories, Holmes stories, that don't have explanations? You know what I'm saying? I mean, they've all got human explanations.
Yeah, no. In fact, one of my favorite ones at the end, I could swear it has the word vampire in the headline, but maybe, or in the title, but maybe not, is about the vampire of Surrey or something like that.
Mm.
And you're just reading, I'm like, what? Really? Oh, okay. That's a good explanation, you know?
Okay. Yeah, but that's what I thought, but I haven't read all of them. So, you know, I couldn't think of one that had a ghost in it. I remember a lot of supernatural element in the Baskervilles. But it was all explained. You know?
Well, and I know that he stopped writing as many stories and started really concentrating more on the spiritualism toward the end of his life.
Okay.
It was always kind of an interest. And then I think his second wife really encouraged it a lot. I can't remember. His first wife died of a very horrible lingering illness. And the second wife was a really good friend of hers. You know, before he married her. And so they were all friends together, and then he married her later.
Gotcha.
And I think she's the one who just maybe encouraged it or something. But he, you know, poor Arthur Conan Doyle. I mean, because he also believed in fairies, and I think there was a famous case where there were pictures of fairies in the bottom of this garden, and he really believed it. And I think at the same time you had Houdini going around discrediting everything and laughing at him, and so it was a huge battle, publicity battle. I mean, you know, you think about the Kardashians and how we laugh at them and stuff, and it's kind of painful to think of Arthur Conan Doyle being exposed to that. But, you know, nobody knew, so people would take sides.
Yeah, that's right.
But he didn't let that come through in these stories, so he was true to Holmes's rational identity.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, so.
Yeah, what's your last one?
My last one is The Man with the Twisted Lip.
The Twisted Lip.
Oh, yeah.
Master of disguise.
That's kind of, well, yes, essentially. But yeah, this one is, it's just one of those weird cases of a missing person that no one can figure out. A woman has gone on an errand. You know, she lives in the country. Her husband works in the city, but she's had to go into town to pick up a special package. And she's coming back through an odd part of town, not a very nice part of town. She's never usually there. And she happens to hear something or glance up, and she sees her husband standing at a window with an expression of horror on his face. And then he falls backward as if somebody's grabbed him by the collar and pulled him back. And she goes rushing in the building, and he's not there. No one can find him. And so all of a sudden she's gone to the police, and his clothes are found in the river. So maybe he's been killed for his money that he had on him. Nobody knows why he was in that building. But what they do find, who was right in the room, who probably pulled him back from the window, is the man with the twisted lip.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets thrown into jail while they're trying to figure this out. And she comes to Holmes because the police aren't really doing anything. But she also got a note mysteriously delivered about a week later that said, "Honey, don't worry. I'm okay. I'm not dead. Everything's fine. Just be patient and all will be revealed later." But he hasn't shown up. So she's just like, "You've got to help me." So he starts looking into it.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is not saying anything. He's still in jail. And there's all these mysterious clues that no one can understand. Like, all the pockets of the guy's clothes were stuffed with pennies and half pennies. Mm-hmm. Hay pennies, as they would have probably said.
Yeah.
And so they couldn't be swept away from the tide. But if he'd been stripped, they said, you know, then the body would have gone out to sea. So, and that's another thing where all these weird, mysterious little details, like, why would anybody have all this small change on them? So much it would weigh everything down.
Yeah.
And what happens is Holmes goes to the jail cell. You know, the guy's not talking, but later he goes to the jail cell and he's asleep, and he has a big sponge and some water and soap with him, and he wipes off his face really quick. So like, he won't even take a bath. He's just that awful. And and everything comes off, and it's the guy, and he was wearing a wig. And I loved his story, which he says, "Okay, I was a journalist, actually, and I did a story on beggars. And so to do the story on beggars, I became a beggar for about a week or two to see how it worked." So he was an undercover investigative reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "You know what I found out? You can make so freaking much money begging, so much more than at my regular job."
Mm-hmm.
"So I became a beggar, but it would have been a disgrace to my wife and especially to the kids." He's really worried about that. And when you think about it, in Victorian England, that would have just been the lowest. You know, no one would have talked to them. Mm-hmm. And so he always hid it. And he was changing clothes when in his low-down dive where his stuff was all hidden, and his wife went by, and he happened to be looking out the window, and the expression of horror was, "No, it's you. You can't see me like this." So in the end, they had to let him go because he wasn't murdered, and he was, in fact, him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are you going to charge me with? Yeah.
Yeah, I just...
You can't charge me with anything because I am alive. I didn't... Yeah.
I just really loved the whole idea that there was no crime, that it was to save everybody's feelings that he did it. He'd given a note to somebody to get to his wife, but through a series of circumstances, it was delayed for about a week. And he said, "Oh no, I didn't know what she would have gone through, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I mean, but he'd made so much money, he was able to buy his house out of town, and you know, it was quite profitable, obviously.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I love the, you know, this is so, it's stereotypical now. Right.
Yeah.
But Holmes stooped to the water jug, moistened his sponge, then rubbed it twice vigorously across and down the prisoner's face. "Let me introduce you," he shouted, "to Mr. Neville St. Clair of Lee in the county of Kent."
Yes.
dun, dun, dun.
With a no, twitch, the wig was gone, did yeah, he say?
Yeah, yeah. Something like that. I just love that, you know, that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aha.
I know, and I also love the inspector. He's a beauty, isn't he? Yeah. He certainly needs a wash.
I can't Let me see. Help him.
He's a beauty.
Get me a sponge.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
shoot.
Think how, if these are this much fun now, and mm-hmm. for everybody who reads them these days, you know, kids usually, mm-hmm. or teenagers, for the first time, and they're still so entrancing. There's something really wonderful about the quirky personalities and all that sort of thing. Yeah. The mysteries are still fresh seeming. Mm-hmm. And because they were written in contemporary London, it makes me think of how people must have felt when they were reading Raymond Chandler when it just came out. Now they're a time capsule for us.
Right, right.
But then they would have been like, you know, the cutting edge detective. But I think one of the things that makes them live so well is Holmes and Watson are good friends, as you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Holmes doesn't have any other friends, really, and he values Watson being around. And a lot of interpretations I've seen show Watson getting treated as a dummy, like whether in movies or even readings of the stories, the tone that they put into Holmes's words or that I put in when I've read them to myself are kind of like, Holmes, you idiot. Or I mean, Watson, you idiot, you know, come on.
Yeah.
Of course you thought that, but I knew this. And when I re-listened to these stories fairly recently, within the last 2 or 3 years, it was because luckily the library had a few of Derek Jacobi's readings of these stories.
Oh, that must be cool. Yeah.
Oh, he's fantastic. He is simply marvelous. And he's done all of them, all the novels and all the stories. And I cannot recommend them enough. And one of the things I really loved is that he makes Holmes rather lighthearted every time he talks to Watson. There's a bit of an affectionate, lighthearted tone. So even when he's kind of laughing at him, it's with affection. And it kind of transformed their relationship for me. Because when you're thinking of it as that bit of a superior attitude from Holmes, you think, why does Watson stick around with this? He just wants him to show off how smart he is. And in these cases, it's, oh, no. I see why you thought that. But here's the thing.
That's cool.
Yeah. And so I really like thinking of them as good friends like that because the fun thing, you know, it's easy to be friends with somebody who you're very much alike, but it makes life more interesting in a lot of ways when you're friends with somebody who's really different from you. And I don't know if you have friends who are like that, but
sure I do.
I was thinking about that after a recent book club, and there were a couple of people who were very shy when they first come to it, and they've suddenly, over time, at different times, they really opened up and they've become friends, really good friends. But the reason they were shy and the reason it was hard to get to know them some is because they were so different, and so I obviously was so different. And it's fun to see the world through their eyes and get their opinions and everything. And I think that's what part of that deep friendship you see here.
Yeah, I agree. And that is a really rewarding part of these stories, is that friendship. But yeah, I like what you've described there. Yeah, I want to hear some of those readings from Jacobi.
Yeah.
Excellent point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and see, I'm influenced by Sherlock, the TV show, when I read these. You know, clearly I read these before Sherlock, but it's been so long that really Sherlock is in my mind when I do that. And I love those two guys. In fact, Martin Freeman, to me, he makes that show. I love Martin Freeman. And his character is as or more interesting to me than Sherlock is in that series.
And I would say especially the first season is a work of genius because if you've read the stories – once you've seen the title, I think, you know, instead of A Study in Scarlet, it's A Study in Pink or something.
Yeah,
but
right.
So you know kind of where the relationship is and the way they show who Holmes and Watson are and set up the mysteries and solve them. And it's really, really well done. And I agree. I love Martin Freeman as Watson. And actually, I like Benedict Cumberbatch as Holmes, although I'm less of a fan of the later two seasons because they kind of just took him and started twisting it more away from the original mysteries. But they do have an affection for each other. It's kind of unwilling sometimes in Watson's part, but
right. So I've heard that they're going to make two more series.
Oh, okay.
And that they have signed it. And this will excite you very much. Uh-huh. Tom Hiddleston to join Sherlock season 4 as third Holmes brother.
A third one.
Yeah, that's what it says.
Okay, they're
so there's just a question. There's a question mark after it, so it's not official. But I know you're a Hiddleston fan.
I am. Mm-hmm. I'm also a Martin Freeman
fan. This poor, ugly man that you feel so much for.
Yeah,
it's very cute.
It's terrible. Well, you know, I'll just go, I don't know what it is. And about like Martin Freeman, and my husband's always like, you like those Scandinavian looking guys. I'm like, Scandinavian? He goes, well, I don't know. They're kind of plain, but they've got the brown hair. And that. And I'm like, I guess they kind of are. I never thought about it that way, you know. I don't think you can describe, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch is just odd looking. And it wasn't until I saw him in, I can't remember the name of the Star Trek movie,
Return to Darkness. Star Trek 2, yeah.
I know, yeah, whatever it was.
Into the Darkness, I think.
When he turns around and he's standing in that duster, which I'm, you know, I'm a sucker for a good duster. He's standing there in that leather duster and he turns around and he's framed against, you know, devastating sky or something. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, my, I've never thought of you like that. I kind of grabbed this one's arm and went, oh, and he's like, oh, Lord.
He's like, oh, good heavens, here we go.
That's me. He's always just a bit odd looking. And the thing is when you look at the descriptions of Holmes, he's supposed to be a good looking guy. I mean, you know, not like drop dead, but he's a handsome man.
Yeah.
Striking features.
Yeah.
And so that actually, I guess that works for, I just think Benedict Cumberbatch is kind of odd looking, really. Mm. If he doesn't have the duster in the scene around him.
Right, yeah.
But
I think he's doing a great job. I love him as Holmes. He's,
oh, no, he's really, really good.
Really terrific.
Interpretation.
Yeah.
But
anyway. Martin Freeman, yeah, there's just something about him that I've really enjoyed over the last several years. Just everything that he's done, he makes way better. He was the reason to watch The Hobbit. I know that you haven't watched it, but if there was a reason, it's for him. Because the scenes that he's in are just like, they're terrific.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Don't ever make me watch that
movie. I will never. Don't you worry.
I'll just have to read the Wikipedia page.
And my next selection is all three Hobbit films.
Wow.
We're going to... And yes, I did call them films.
This is the this is the torture section of the podcast, everyone.
Yes.
Well, at some point,
at some point, we're going to read Dante, and I figured that this might be preparation
for Inferno.
For Inferno, right?
Yes, but there, Dante himself is not going through the tortures of hell. He is observing them.
Oh, okay.
He's not having to suffer through them himself. That's part of the point. He's learning before he gets stuck there.
I love it. That's funny. So have you watched the American, I don't know what that's called. Isn't there an American show that's... currently based on Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen it. Clearly, I have not seen it. I was just curious.
Is it called Elementary?
That's it. You're right. Elementary.
Yeah, we tried the first couple, and frankly, it just couldn't hold a candle to the very strong start that Sherlock made, the BBC Sherlock.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched any of the older ones? Who was that guy's name? Jeremy Brett?
Basil Rathbone or something like that. Is okay, that not right?
But I thought Jeremy Brett did like all BBC, like, you know, they did every single one of them, and he was considered the seminal interpreter in visual form or
Yeah, maybe Basil Rathbone is older than that. Yeah, 1939.
Yeah, yeah.
No, so I don't know why his name was in my head. And you're, the name of the other guy was who?
Jeremy Brett.
Jeremy Brett. Yeah, there we go. Oh, yeah, I recognize him.
Yeah, it's we all kind of know how he looks, and he had the deer stalker and all those things. And, you know, my problem is, and I know I've mentioned this before, if I really love a book, I really don't usually care about seeing it on the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that he probably, if I was going to watch somebody a lot, it would be him, because I think they're very faithful, good interpretations and that sort of thing. And he may have read a bunch of audiobooks too.
Oh, cool.
I could be wrong about that though.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, there was a character named Sexton Blake. Have you ever heard of Sexton Blake? I found out he was sort of a contemporary. Well, I say sort of. I don't know why I say sort of. He was a contemporary. But I think that he had a lot of different writers over the years. But he was very Sherlock Holmes-like.
Okay.
So it says here that the first Sexton Blake story was The Missing Millionaire, written by Harry Blythe on 20 December 1893.
Hmm.
In the story paper, The Halfpenny Marvel. So, but there's a audio dramatist named Dirk Maggs that I just love. And he did The Adventures of Sexton Blake, and they are comedies, and they are absolutely wonderful.
Oh, really?
They are madcap, chaotic, hilarious. You know, Sexton, you know, that moment where he wiped the guy's face that I read. The whole thing's like that. The whole thing. He's like, you know, Sexton Blake is in that audio drama is just over the top hilarious.
One sensational thing after another.
Yeah, but it's clearly supposed to be, you know, taken from Sherlock Holmes. You know, he's poking fun at the whole thing, and
that's funny.
Yeah, it's hilarious. If you haven't heard it, I urge you to.
I can get you that note.
Yeah. It's funny stuff.
Well, you know, something that occurred to me about these, because you were saying, you know, these aren't very Catholic, but, and it was like, what does it matter, you know?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I said there
wasn't many Catholic things to talk about, is what I said.
No, yeah. Well, friendship is one.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because friends are what help us get through every time somebody shows up with a cheetah and a baboon roaming the halls at night and a speckled band.
Right.
But, also, it made me think about when you were talking about, do you try to solve the mysteries when you're reading them? Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe there are different mysteries that we're more inclined to try to solve than others.
Yeah.
But it kind of comes back to that question of why do we like mysteries? And I've seen someone saying, and I feel sure it was a Catholic somewhere, but someone saying that because – well, for one thing, we have creative, inventive minds, and we like to see patterns, and puzzle solving is a natural thing, or I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you on Skype. But also that idea of life is a mystery anyway. And if you have faith, you're always – you feel like you have the grasp of the solution. It's how do you do the part in the middle? You know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
What are the clues that get you to that? And then how do you work it through in your own life?
Yeah.
You know, it's always kind of...
I've always been drawn to the Catholic admission that some things are mysteries and that's okay. It's not... In fact, it should be that way. You know, if we knew what God was exactly, then how could that be God that we're describing?
Right.
You know, so there are things that we don't understand, and they are mysteries, and we contemplate them, and we try to get closer, and we try to understand, but the concept that we won't quite grasp, no matter how much we try, is very acceptable to me.
Yeah, because there are facets that you can get. And it's like reading one of these mysteries and going, oh, I did get that part.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that.
Right.
And in fact, that happened to me just yesterday. I was reading something in the backyard and my attempt to kind of not push things, but to kind of go, oh, here I am. Mm-hmm. Anything that I should know, you know, kind of thing. And I was reading a few things, quotes I'd written down for myself. And this one line sprang out and just slapped me in the face. And I was like, I know I've known this, but it's never hit me this way. And it was that, of course, there was that grateful, excited connection, but it was also that I have to hold on to this. This is a key to this mystery. You know, it's I can't describe it, but it's that connection feeling. And it was like, oh, I got this in that mystery.
Mm. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yep. I love that.
Yeah, I'll really, never get really the whole mystery. Hopefully, when I die,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But I'm in the right place to start to know more. But
And we do know more. I mean, you know, I don't want to give the impression that we are like, well, you shouldn't look into this. I mean, do. You consider it. You contemplate it. You get closer, and things start to make sense. And but still. You know, there's this concept of mystery that I love.
Well, yeah, and it's part of that is because it's the same reason I was in the backyard going, so what am I missing? And which you might get nothing to. You might just sit there and go, well, it's a nice day today. But the thing is it's because it's about friendship, right? It's about, to use that dreaded word, relationship. And so if you're trying to grow closer to God, who is a person, it's like you and me. We will surprise each other because each person is a mystery to the other. You never know everything. And that's part of what being friends is.
Yeah.
Too.
Nice. I like it. I agree. It's great.
Yeah. So.
Well, cool. Well, I guess we should wrap this up.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But we do have, you know, many, many other stories to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The more Sherlock Holmes movies. All right. So what do we have next? We have a musical.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Something completely different.
Now for something completely different. Guys and dolls. Yes.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Sit down. You're rocking the boat.
Yeah. Best song in the whole thing. And I would say this is the most American of all musicals, which is, I think, in itself an American art form. So there you go.
Yeah, love it. It'll be great. I'm looking forward to talking about that.
Fun.
Yeah, it should be great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess I better get to picking, huh? It's coming right up.
That's right. We're running out of choices.
All of a sudden. That's right.
Yeah, so if you want to know what we're doing past that, we're just mentioning one, but check the sidebar. We aren't going way out, but to keep up on books and movies ahead of time.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Go to the website, agoodstoryishardtofind.blogspot.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right.
And we also have a Facebook page, though that stuff isn't linked to there. But if you look for A Good Story Is Hard to Find, I always put the most recent thing and you can click through to the website also from there.
Oh, so, cool. And then we also have a Twitter feed that sometimes I neglect, but sometimes I post on. It's
there
called,
you go.
It's at Good Story Found.
Ah, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yep. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.